Всім добрий вечір. Всі ми тут.
On behalf of the brave. We have freedom. Give us wings to protect it.
Наші військові тут. Громадяни суспільства тут. Всі ми тут. Захищаємо нашу незалежність. Нашу державу. Так буде і далі. Слава нашим захисникам, слава нашим захисницям. Слава Україні!
David, I will advertise the hell of the podcast. Everyone will hear about the podcast, and it's going to be podcast everywhere. So that's the option I will go for. So my sincerest apologies. And in the meantime, how do you do, sir?
Oliven, doing well. How are you?
Reasonably pissed not to be able to use the phone as I wanted to. But beside that, I'm doing well. So I wanted to ask you about 500,000 questions. I will settle for one to begin with. And I wanted to know if you could introduce yourself, at least your Twitter persona, because you're one of the most intriguing and fascinating, I would say, character in our sphere. And I wanted to know if you could tell us a little bit more about you and what interests you.
My Twitter persona was very overtly pre-February 2022. A bicyclist and pedestrian advocate, and that's kind of how I started posting. Although I've had my account for 14 years, you know, and there's reasons why I. In the United States, about 40,000 people are killed from crashes with automobiles, primarily. So that's a thing. Anyway, since 2022, you know, I was. Started my interaction with the Ukrainian support community in NAPA by kind of lurking and then learning, ultimately starting to just get my lay of the land literally and doing my internal research, and then finally starting to hopefully contribute some perspective that's maybe adds to discussion, you know, as I've gone along, you know, hopefully. That's grown. My Twitter persona for NAFO is providing situational awareness on the environmental factors that shape the operations, offensive operations, trying to look ahead, you know, some months, looking retrospectively. You know, there's probably I hate Twitter because it's just this random noise machine, but, you know, you can kind of pick out nuggets of wisdom if you work at it and kind of look back and see where the signal is and filter out the 99% of the noise. So I spend time thinking about that and, you know, using it for what it's worth to kind of share my opinion and share the information from what I've learned. So does that help?
Yeah, it does. It paints you as both mysterious and interesting character. As everyone who has ever followed the spaces on OSINT with Hello Mr. Bond and Exit and Jacoby have knows full well. All right, so if it's okay with you, I'd like to start with the Black Sea and then to go a little bit further north and talk about the Dnipro and what's happening with the water over there. So we're going to have a very water-based discussion, and first we're going to go salty and then sweet water. Is it okay by you?
Sure.
Fantastic. All right. So first of all, I'd like to go for the boring question. So if anyone needs to get a cup of coffee, now is the time. But I need to ask you about your sources. I'm sure you're highly knowledgeable, but how do you follow the weather and, I don't know, how do you call the weather in the sea? These sort of things. How do you get this information? What's your, well, I guess, is it OSINT? If it's, yeah, well, you know. Where do you get your stuff from?
Well, so I get my stuff. Well, first, you know, my career as a meteorologist included shift work on the high seas desk and at NOAA. So I used to put out wave and wind forecasts and analyses for the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. I've also had a stint with the National Ice Center, where I supported Navy Arctic and Antarctic operations and National Science Foundation and near the polar regions. You know, I have that history. So, you know, when it came to, hey, you know, I was talking to Exit, well, what are the weather sensitivities that we should be looking at? And, you know, can we correlate whether or not the Russians are going to do some inspections today, whether or not if it's wavy or not? And so part of the work began there is, let's just document and more of a curation aspect approach and see what the data, put that out there, document it and a level of detail, and then see if we can do some correlations between, you know, are they just blowing smoke up our rear ends about why they didn't go out that day? Or was there some causation that may be attributed to weather? So where I get my data, you know, the primary, there's lots of wave models that are run by different, you know, European and countries and the Greek hydrometeorological products is what they have a nice display for the Black Sea. It's, you know, purely open source. There's nothing magical about it, but it's based on the WaveWatch 3 model, which actually knew the modeler, the scientist that developed that model, and it's been kind of open sourced and used by many countries. So somewhat familiar with it, good model, but it can be run by anybody anywhere in any body of water to figure out what the wave spectra is. The, you know, I like to check what happened in reality. There's not a lot of in situ weather observations. There's no buoys in the Black Sea. So I tend to use scatterometry from ASCAT that's available through UMETSAT. So I occasionally share that information with Exit and some of our threads. So, I mean, the keys to, I think, weather sensitivities for some of the USV operations, small boats, that kind of thing, riverine craft. I mean, they're going to be sensitive to waves. They're probably not going to venture out, you know, over 2 or 3 meter waves. So I look at, you know, the way that Black Sea is a closed system, doesn't have wave swells coming into it from the Bosphorus. It's fairly kind of a simple, although there's some weirdness to it in terms of the mixing and some of the oxygen levels, but that's a different thing in terms of the thermal climb and oxygen levels. But just for operations, you know, pretty simple. You know, I get the data, again, mostly from satellite scatterometry, model analyses, which are pretty good, informed by satellite data and a wave model. So does that answer the question?
Yeah, it does. Oh. However, you could have gone a little faster just telling me, I'm doing what every 15-year-old girl dreams to do, an oceanographer. That's really cool. So yeah, no. So it was maybe still is how you earned your BIFTEC, and basically that's you allowing us to benefit from several years of experience. That's fantastic.
The key is the weather sensitivities. I mean, what are the, you know, I mean, weather is weather, and it's kind of, so what, until you can figure out, you know, what makes things, you know, what's an operational decision for a weapon system, a vessel, and try and inch your way into that. And that's not public domain, but you can kind of see by, you know, the CONOPS that you observe over time and infer some of the sensitivities to the system and to the operational missions.
Okay. Yeah. You're right. There's never a weather. The weather is a postmodern concept. It's all, you're all, always somebody's weather. That's not remarked to open with. Thank you, David. So I wanted to pick your brain about a couple of questions I had about the Black Sea. The first one is, our friend Daniele did some wizardry with the computers and determined that the claim that a Ukrainian mine had drifted by March 22nd into the Bosphorus all the way from assumingly Odessa or some region around there, in just a month was very nearly physically impossible. Did you ever have this sort of question in front of your eyes? And can you opine on this whole mind drifting business and this case in particular?
I didn't track the original assertion that some mine from a Ukrainian mine had somehow drifted, you know, from the Odessa area, you know, down through the Bosphorus and somehow got into the shipping lanes. But, you know, with Exit, I mean, I've been looking at the little eddies that develop and the Black Sea and the general circulation. And there's two kind of counterclockwise circulations in the west and the east, Black Sea and the Gulf of Odessa. There's a lot of little eddies. But generally, the currents, they drift along the Black Sea, the western Black Sea shore, to the southwest and south, towards the Bosphorus. However, the currents are incredibly slow. And I don't know if it's 1 or 2 meters per hour, if that. And, you know, there's always internal eddies. It's not a straight shot. It's kind of a meandering thing. And so, you know, a month to get down there, I hadn't done the math, but it just very skeptical. And, you know, I think they're just, so anyway, that's my uninformed response. But it's the Black Sea currents are mostly wind driven. And, you know, just because I say the currents generally go kind of counterclockwise in the western Black Sea, basically along the western shore of Romania and Bulgaria. It's, you know, if there's a wind system, let's say a low pressure system that has stronger southwest winds, southwest to northeast, that's where the current's going to go. So, you know, it's an extreme generalization when I say that. So, highly, highly, highly unlikely. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, it does. And it takes us a little bit further, which means that how would you determine the risk of mines in the Black Sea? I mean, mines are always dangerous, of course, but if we compare to, I don't know, the North Atlantic, strong winds, very strong currents, a mine is here one day and, I don't know, 3 days later, it's 30 or 40 miles, not 2 miles away. Would you say that the in that respect, both in terms of the sea and the currents, the mines are much more manageable danger in the Black Sea than it would be in a more active body of water?
You know, I think that's probably true. You know, Exxon and I have kind of, I think the frequency of, let's say, gale storms in the Black Sea, so winds greater than 35 knots that really start to generate currents and enough wave energy to perhaps loosen a tethered mine and make it go from untethered to drifting. And there's been a storm or two where I said, this is a strong one, Exit. I think there's going to be a mine or two that are going to be discovered. And I don't know if I was lucky or not, but anyway, a mine did turn up like a day or two later. So I think the Black Sea being mostly a pretty benign environment and closed environment, the mine's generally going to stay where they're tethered, where they're put. I think most mines are, you know, they're not made to kind of drift about for no particular, randomly. That's not a, probably doesn't have a military operation, especially when the Russians actually, you know, everybody's got their commercial shipping and I don't think, you know, most countries are interested in random ships being blown up. I think the point of the mines is to either restrict or protect access to particular ports. And so they're going to be fixed and they're going to be fixed until they're not, as a consequence either some corrosion or most likely some weather event that dislodges them. But, and then once that happens, I think you can kind of predict where they might go in the short term. In the long term, I think over statistically, you know, what have we seen exit? She knows better than I. 30 mines, 40 mines over 18 months or whatever it is now.
The fund 17.
17.
Yeah. But
so that order of magnitude, right, that we've actually found and identified, probably a lot more that went for a walkabout and we just never, you know, found them. But, you know, generally, it's, I think one can say that the amount of damage from those 17 identified mines has been limited relative to the amount of ships that have been, you know, plying the Black Sea over that period, you know, thousands of ships. So I would say in terms of risk, if it was a real risk, then I think the insurance companies would be like, oh, no, thank you. I'm not going to insure the cargo for any country, not let alone Ukraine. But they continue to operate, right? So I would agree that the Black Sea is generally, you know, the mines generally stay where they are. There's when they get loose, they drift slowly. And we've got the statistical kind of one thing that I do use meteorologically is a Lagrangian kind of forensic meteorology to try and figure out where like a nuclear parcel might go once it's released, or maybe if you find a biological, you detect it somewhere, where did it come from? And there's a model called Hyslett. So, I mean, you can do kind of these forensic analysis with currents and atmospheric winds to backtrack if you have the model in it. Capacity. I suppose that was what was done with the one mine to disprove that it's even possible. But anyway, so I'm in agreement with you, Ben, on the characterization of the Black Sea and it's what happens with mines there.
Okay, fantastic. I think we can file this one and use it later on for maybe a conclusion, tentative conclusion. Now, I wanted to move from the mines to those vessels that are likely to drop them. If we assume that the Russians would really, really like to interrupt one way or another the Ukrainian corridor that runs from Odessa to the Ukraine, to the Romanian national waters, would you, like, they cannot send there just a regular frigate or destroyer or whatever sort of ship that usually lays mines. They need to send there something much more subtle, namely a submarine. And the question is, how likely is it for the Russians to manage to drop mines via submarines really, really close to the Romanian and Ukrainian coast? And when we talked about this the last time, you had a bit of a bombshell for me, which is not very prudent when there are mines around, but there you go. So, David, how likely is it for a Russian submarines to lay mines next to the Ukrainian and Romanian coast?
Well, you look at the topography or the bathymetry in the Northwest Black Sea, and particularly in the humanitarian corridor that the Ukrainians have identified or laid out for the International Marine Organization, IMO, and basically the corridors that have been followed by the four bulkers, I guess, that have left the Ukrainian ports since, you know, late July. And in those corridors, I think the depth of the water is somewhere between 20 and 50 feet. The submarines, I believe, and maybe we need somebody to tell us, but they really operate in 200 foot of water. And, I think that it's problematic for them to get in the shallow areas. Their draft, you know, is 20 or 30 feet to begin with, let alone kind of operating at depth and doing their, you know, mine seeding operation. I was skeptical, and Exit and I have gone back and forth about this, but, you know, I'm skeptical and I think that's why the Ukrainians, you know, not only did they say, well, we're going to keep these corridors close to the coast so that we can perhaps protect them and provide cover if we need to. And we've seen on some of the Sentinel data, Sentinel 2 data, some escort vessels that have tagged along with the bulkers as they headed in along the corridor, but also because the likelihood of a sub trying to get in there and kind of seeding mines and that would ultimately threaten these vessels, these cargo vessels, is low. So that's my analysis of the situation.
Okay. Yeah. Fantastic. That was really, really surprising for me, because I would have thought that submarines could just, you know, move about in a puddle. But what you pointed out is that A, they can't, and B, there's also the question of the risk for them, which, do you really want to risk one of your only four submarines in the Black Sea to lay mines, which may or may not hit their intended target? So that was very, very interesting. Of course, you're not a submariner. I'm not a submariner, so there can always be some doubts, and people can rightfully contradict us. But at the very least, it's a tantalizing answer that you provide us, which is that the route might be a lot safer than we might otherwise think. So thank you very, very much for those two realizations. That was great. Is there something that you think most of us should understand about the Black Sea and the weather system in the Black Sea that we might be missing, or do you think the information is there and well shared?
You know, we're going into the second winter, headed into it. I've looked at like the what was the big storm in the Crimean War that wrecked the British and the Russian fleet. I mean, there's been historically some amazing storms that have had some really tragic consequences on shipping and warships. The Black Sea, generally, it's kind of benign. It can turn very dangerous for boating at times, and particularly in the winter. The summer, as we've seen, there's a lot of opportunities for small boats to go amazingly long distances, you know, 600 and 800 kilometer range. But those opportunities will be probably less as we go into the winter, and the frequency of the gale storms pick up. It might be on the order right now. It's one every month or so over the summer, and probably in the winter it's going to be one every 3 to 5 days.
Okay, you will mind the storms. All of us hobbyists sailing across the Black Sea with our little dinghies. Okay, so we've reached the first half of the conversation. I'd love it if we could move on to the second half. Although before doing this, I of course invite anyone who is listening to come up and ask a question if they want to ask a question about the Black Sea. In the meantime, I will take the opportunity to, David, thank you again for those. But those two conclusions that for me really changed my appreciation of the situation, the first one being that the Black Sea is benign and probably not the worst place when it comes to the risk associated with mines, and the second one being that the topography underwater next to the coastline actually favors the security of the grain corridors that Ukraine is trying to open. So it's cautious optimism is really, really good, and thank you for providing this to me, at least, and I assume to a few other people listening. So now I want to move on a bit further north and start talking about the Dnieper. This is a segment I know a lot less about, but hearing you talk about it recently made me realize how very, very important it was. So back in June, when the dam was broken, there was a lot of attention paid to it, and then this attention very quickly receded. Would you be able to give us a sort of what happened after the dam broke, and where are we now?
Yeah, I just, because I can't help myself, I did a 40-something long thread last night in preparation for our discussion, and that I had hoped to finish that a couple weeks ago. I know Hans was encouraging me, and I really wanted to get there, but there was always get my arms around what has happened. It's a difficult thing because, you know, it's a multidimensional problem with the meteorology and the hydrology and ecology and the military activities, you know, how that interacts with the built environment, the infrastructure with the natural environment. So, you know, I think there's some interesting papers that were written. I think one of which I'll say was Dr. Jakub Deduka. He's the head of the Department of Geobotany Ecology, and he's in the Ukrainian National Academy of Sciences. He's the only author, the only scientist in Ukraine that was writing for the IPCC, the international climate folks that write, you know, what's happening with changes to global warming and all the effects. So he was writing on ecology of climate change. And he did a field study, boots on the ground, the little park on the right bank of the Dnipro, and where the water had drained. And he's standing there in July looking at the plants seeding that are sprouting, the seedlings, and looking at the transformation, or as he called it, the tachyrotization of the soil, which is basically it's baking and crust is forming. And his statement is, you know, in a dry state, the tachyr soils are high strength and they can be used for vehicular traffic. And the man knows his soils. So if he said it, I'm gonna take that as credible source. I think the papers that have been written by some of the ecologists are worth reviewing, and that I tried to do that and to try and get a sense of what I'm seeing on the satellites, and what we're seeing from the OSINT kind of reporting that comes in random. And every time I saw a video or some images of the Dnipro flood plain former Kakhovka reservoir, I tagged it, I bookmarked it, so I could go back and kind of look at the timeline, and which is what I did.
If I summarize, what you're saying is that this Jakub, forgotten his last name,
D-I-D-U-K-H, Dikta, I think. Okay, no, I can't but pronounce it. But anyway, it's in the thread, and I'll put the his background information. I'll send it to you.
Okay, fantastic. So this professor is saying that it is possible to get very, very close to the Dnipro, and that what used to be a very difficult cross river has now become something a lot more simple to cross. That's what you're saying. The fact on the ground for the military has changed.
I think it's trending in that direction. I mean, we haven't seen, I mean, every time I see a good pass from Sentinel-2, I'll try and see if there's any evidence that somebody has even done a test run to see if there's a lot of, I mean, some of those grasses that have been in some of the tweets that come out from the floodplain, they're over a meter tall in some of these. And I think it's probably 75 to 80% of the former reservoir is now not wetlands. It's dry. And it's been, you know, really drying, particularly for the last 6 to 8 weeks. It was rather rainy in the end of June and early July, but subsequently it's been dry. And yeah, I think that it's very possible. And we know ultimately it's about ground pressure of the vehicle. Like a 113 has a lot less, particularly the surface pressure. Ground pressure of the 113 is much less than, let's say, a six vehicle, the AMC 10 or the tank, the French tank or whatever you want to call it.
Not a tank.
Not a tank. Right. Check. So, but that vehicle has a huge ground pressure because it's wheeled and it's heavy, but a 113, not so much. But I think, you know, in a dry state, probably the AMC 10 would certainly be able to cross the tachyr soils. But I'd obviously love to see a test run. I'd love to see my hypothesis tested, but there's been nothing thus far. And maybe, again, in my thread, maybe it's just that it's not that the problem is the soil strength and its ability to hold a military vehicle. It's maybe it's not the ability to build a pontoon bridge, which we know that Ukrainians have been provided those kind of engineering equipment. Maybe the problem is that, you know, like we saw with the survey Donets River crossing that the Russians attempted, that once you concentrate your vehicles and they're kind of not moving very much and trying to get across the river, they can be attacked rather easily if you have our artillery within, what, you know, 15 kilometers or so. That's the problem, and not necessarily the environmental problem, you know, limits. So anyway, I think it's not the weather that's stopping Ukraine at this point from taking advantage of, and, you know, the thing about the floodplain, there's not a lot of mines there. There's not a lot of fortifications for, you know, all the Yosin to what we're seeing, you know, in Zaporizhia and what the Ukrainian military has to go through, and ever strengthened the fortifications there. So that, I think that's, you know, again, an opinion based on kind of tactics and military strategy, which that's not my forte. But what I'm seeing is the meteorology and the hydrology and the soil science seems to support increasing likelihood of at least opportunity space for you to travel across that floodplain.
Please, can you just explicit a little bit this for me? Because it's really not something I understand. Travel where to? You think that the Ukrainian army can cross the floodplain and find itself on the rear of the Russian army at some point?
Yeah, I mean, I did a thread, I think it was June 20th, and I identified 7 old roads that predated the flooding of the floodplains by the reservoir in 1955. And those roadbeds supported vehicles in this fairly marshy, wet environment that is, you know, the big reservoirs. I think there was maybe one north of Kakhovka before they flooded it, but I think the Kakhovka was one of the second big reservoir that ultimately would be 6 reservoirs on the Ukrainian portion of the Dnipro. And so you'd have seasonal flooding in the spring. And yet, you know, again, there was over 30,000 people that had to be removed or evicted from the floodplain when they eventually flooded it. You know, settlements there, roads there, people were making a living farming and doing what you do to, you know, to live and forage. So it's, you know, the Germans crossed it, the Red Army crossed it. So there's, you know, what if it was done before, you know, when it was a wetland / marsh / meadow, and it's evolving into that now, of course you could do it again. Why wouldn't? I mean, I think it's just we think that it's always going to be this boggy mess. But no, it's going to return to what it was. And there are road bases that were already built that supported heavy vehicles, you know, into the 50s that exist in that floodplain, that transit and cross that floodplain. And I did an analysis on, well, you know, how long would the, you know, at these 7 places, which is a little bit arbitrary, but where these 7 roads cross and transited the floodplain, what's the distance across? What's the likely width of the Dnipro at those locations? Is it favorable or not favorable? Or, you know, is the Dnipro on the left bank or the right bank? If it's on the left bank, that's probably not the best thing, because now you're bumping up against the immediate defenses. So if it's on the right bank, then maybe do a little bit further away from the Russians and you have an opportunity to defend yourself. So, you know, that was a June 20th thread, but anticipating that eventually there'd be an opportunity to cross it. And one of the opportunities I hypothesized, you know, where you might want to cross would be using the old rope beds. In fact, there's at least one bridge that you can see on Sentinel that is near Kakhovka, the roadbed there that's on the imagery. So they didn't, you know, while the Russians kind of, or the Soviets, when they flooded the floodplain, they bulldozed and got rid of a lot of the wood and such, so that the water quality wouldn't be bad and the navigation wouldn't be, you know, hung up by a lot of debris. But there's still obvious evidence in today's imagery of those roadbeds that is kind of right there.
Okay. Yeah, that's good to know, I guess. I wasn't expecting to talk about this. I thought we were going to speak about the water for the nuclear power plants on the one hand, and potentially the ecological consequences of the flood. Do you have something to say about either of those two subjects?
There were some new citations from the Glick paper that he and his co-authors included that I cited last night. But I've also got a paper that I looked at, and I did back of the envelope view. And I've been almost every day when the water level of the cooling pond is reported. It's reported almost every day, maybe 5 or 6 times a week. I've been developing a spreadsheet, so I track it. And I think we've lost, it started off, I think it's relative to the Black Sea cooling pond level. I think it was close to 17 meters. I think we've lost about 0.6 meters through mostly evaporation. The evaporation NPP doesn't require a lot of water right now because it's mostly in a cold state or some variant therein. There are, I think, spent rods in the pond that are, you know, kind of increasing the temperature and that of the water, and that water, if you increase the temperature, then it increases the evaporation. But so it's losing about a millimeter a day, which, okay, what's that mean? But even though the cooling pond, which is a very large pond, I'm not going to quote the, you know, cubic meters offhand, but let's just say there's a heck of a lot of water there. But it's, so the main problem is, well, you know, when does it dry up? And so therefore, what is the base? And I think the base is somewhere around 12 meters above the Black Sea. So basically what we're seeing is the mirror error around the kind of the levee that was built that basically bisected the Kanka River, you know, estuary of the Dnipro circa 1955. And it's not a bottomless pit. It's probably about 4 meters deep. And if you think of the volume, we're down about 0.6 meters of a, you know, at least the vertical dimension of that pool is at maybe 5-ish meters deep, you know, and we're clipping along at 1 millimeter per day loss, and there'll be some rain in the winter, so it might get blissed up. You know, I don't think we're in any kind of a threat of, you know, loss of water from the pool itself, probably until early next summer. And even then, there's been reports of wells being drilled. The problem with wells being in the area is the Dnipro obviously dropped. It dropped about 10 meters in Nikopol from a high of 16, 17 meters relative to the Black Sea. It's down to about 6 meters right now. So, you know, some of the wetlands we're seeing is because the groundwater is kind of oozing out into that, you know, it's going in the direction of gravity. It's going to take it, right, from the higher elevations to the lower elevation, and it's oozing into the wetlands and to the river itself. So those wells, if you drill the well and happen to be at 18, 16 meters and you go down 10 or whatever, those wells are going to go dry. It's not just for the nuclear power plant, but also anybody who's stopgap is a well that goes down, you know, a fair amount of, you know, 10 or 15 meters. If you don't go deep, and just because you go deep doesn't mean that you'll find water. It's kind of in these layers, right? The groundwater. So at any rate, there's the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant water, cooling water situation is by no means critical, but it's certainly worth watching. Is that helpful?
It is very helpful. I think that also an encouragement to, as you said, keep watching, because this is, hopefully this will not lead to anything, but it is a subject we need to stay cognizant about. David, I've actually exhausted the questions I wanted to ask you. I feel that it's a bit of a shame considering your amount of information, and I'd love to ask you more. If again, I encourage people, if you want to come up and ask a question, everyone is welcome. But if no one is coming up, I think that would be a nice place to wrap it up. And David, is there something you would encourage us to think about or to know, or maybe a couple of interesting meteorology or Black Sea related actors on Twitter that accounts, I'm sorry, the word was eluding me. Are there a couple of accounts that you would like us to know about and follow to know more about this space?
You know, as far as meteorology and oceanography, you know, we have people who track the vessels extremely well between, you know, Sutton and MT. These guys are awesome about what's happening, what the vessels are doing, and stolen grain. What is it, Yuri, I think, that monitors the Bosphorus. Just amazing work they do. But this, you know, it's not very sexy and not very newsworthy.
You're very sexy. What are you?
I mean, the shaping and environmental information kind of contextualizes how you think about what's happening. And I think it's, personally, I think it's a good thing to track. But because it's not direct military application, not typically, it's not really done by that many people. And not probably, you know, and my approach is, I look at the weather every day. I actually put out a forecast, and it's not particularly useful that much, but it does force me to look at the weather every day. And it does cause me to keep, in a way, the information I put out when OSEN starts to see, like, oh, look, when did that tree line get obliterated? When did that battle happen? You have, I think I'm kind of almost for a year, every day I put out a forecast, and that forecast includes a satellite image, includes temperatures and winds and precipitation that are occurring along the line of conflict, and kind of a daily forecast. So you get the sense of where the fronts are and all that good stuff. But it also helps identify, there's always a lot of uncertainty on the OSINT you see. And, you know, it doesn't come with a solid daytime group or information. People work hard for that. So what I'm trying to do is curate the information so that it's easily retrievable. And so if we say, well, those conditions, look at that image, it's very dry. You know, it couldn't have been this period of time because it was wet and raining. And the vegetation either was just budding out or was barren or what have you. Again, the curated information kind of help give you some clues to contextualize that so that you can at least neck it down to some time frame, some location that kind of makes sense. So unfortunately, I can't recommend other meteorologist types that are kind of doing this on a daily basis. Again, it doesn't have a lot of shock value, but over time, I think it's useful.
Fantastic. I guess we're going to wrap it up. It was Touching the Talk with David Elves. First of all, thank you very much, David, for joining us. Of course, you can find us, as usual, on our podcast. Since you're here and I can give a few advice on what to listen to, there is our friend Mr. Bond and Exit. They have spaces, if I'm not mistaken, every Thursday and every Sunday European night. They are great. You, David, often intervene on those spaces, so do have a listen. And when it comes to following up the more military stuff, Andrew Pavertra has a YouTube broadcast on a regular basis. I don't remember the days, but he's great. I always learn a lot. He has a tremendous attention to detail and particularly to the question of the terrain. So if you're interested in geography, that is definitely a good place to listen to the news. And our friend Exit is often intervening there. So that's it for me today. David, once more, thank you very, very much. That was so very informative. I learned so much. I'm looking at the Black Sea to write a little something with my friend Daniele these days, and you really, really helped us a lot. That's tremendously, tremendously helpful. Thank you very, very much. Thank you, everybody, for listening and for not being too upset at my numerous technical issues. I wish you a very, very good day. And David, I'll leave you the send-off.
Yeah, Ben, thanks for asking me to chat with you. It was fun. And, you know, look forward to potential future tag-ups. But it was great being here. Thank you.